And now another in our special series of summer features on PM. Today we look at how Norfolk Islanders are coming to grips with the upheaval caused by the end of self-government on Australia's tiny external territory. When the families of the famous Bounty mutineers arrived 160 years ago, they were just the latest in successive waves of people to call the island home. Nick Grimm travelled to Norfolk to see how its inhabitants have left their mark over the centuries and how they're helping reshape its future.
A lot of pine seeds dropping. Oh, here, so these are the pine seeds.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of wild spinach over here. That was here when they were. It's native to Norfolk.
So that would have been on the diet?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we used to eat a lot when we were kids.
If you know where to look, Norfolk Island has hidden secrets. And take a walk around with someone like John Christian and you can learn a little about what the locals know.
How do you prepare that, John?
Just like you do any silver beet or spinach or whatever. It's a little bit salty, that's all. There's a salt here and that comes in.
You don't need to add any seasoning then?
No, salt in it.
John Christian is a member of one of Norfolk Island's oldest families. In fact, he's a sixth-generation descendant of the famous bounty mutineer Fletcher Christian. John has lived here all his life and pretty much knows as much about the place as anyone. So today, he's taken me to where life on the island all began.
John Christian, we're surrounded by these towering Norfolk pines. We're standing in a bit of a depression in the ground. Now, can you just explain for me, please, what it is we have around us?
Well, according to history, the first settlement here was Polynesians, and that was between 400 and 800 years ago. They had a permanent settlement here. No reason given why they left. They all packed up and left Norfolk.
It would be years before humans would step again on Norfolk Island, but those original inhabitants did leave some clues to their existence. Not long after the first fleet reached Australia, the man who'd go on to become a governor of the new colony, Philip Gidley King, sailed to Norfolk Island on board HMS Sirius to establish a second settlement. And he stumbled across the first traces of those vanished people.
When Gidley King arrived in 1788, the first thing he found was a patch of bananas growing. Bananas don't grow from seed, they grow from cuttings. So humans had to plant them. And after a little while, he found an abandoned old Polynesian canoe.
But it would take another 200 years for archaeologists to visit the island and begin excavating a site near a popular swimming spot. As the island's former forester, John Christian was invited to join the excavation to help ensure the site's Norfolk pine trees came to no harm.
Yeah, I was down here to make sure they didn't cut any of these roots around here, the pine trees, and damaging any of the pines. But they didn't really know what they were doing and what they were looking for until they uncovered a whole village that was here.
And can you just point out for me what was here?
Well, underneath where we're standing, this whole area is paved. All the fireplaces are still intact. There is a small stone raised up platform they thought was the ceremonial centre of the village, or the pa, as the Polynesians call it. Some posts that are still sticking out of the paving used probably for permanent huts. So there was a permanent settlement here underneath us. All their rocks, we found artefacts here. Some of it's made out of Norfolk granite and chips of obsidian. No obsidian is part of Norfolk. It actually came from an island about 800 miles east of Norfolk called the Kermadec's Group, Royal Island. It's an active volcano. So they brought either with them or went back and forth between here. We're not too sure what happened there. the rocks for making their stone tools and their sharp cutting-edge tools.
Now, I should just explain that this site is actually sitting below a magnificent stand of Norfolk Island pines, and this is where your involvement comes in, I guess, because as a forester here on the island, you were part of the involvement in the excavation of a site which is now slowly being destroyed by the roots of these trees.
That probably will be right, yeah. They didn't know that the site was here in 1953 when they planted all the pines here. These pines have been planted since 1953. There were talk, I don't know whether it's still going to happen, of excavating it again and building a glass dome over the top of it to preserve it. I'm not too sure what's happened underneath now, and that's one of the big worries and problems we have with it.
It's a dilemma for the local community, but I'm also left to wonder what happened to those original inhabitants of Norfolk Island. Here under the trees, you can almost sense their ghosts.
You can see why they would have set up a settlement here all those hundreds of years ago. It's a beautiful location.
This whole area here was swamp. There was swamp all through here. And the first convicts and the first settlements drained the whole swamp for farming practices. So it was pretty swampy.
So maybe not so idyllic.
Oh, it would have been good because swamp is where they get a lot of eels and things like that out of it.
So where did they all go? Before I leave the island, I'm going to find out more about the once thriving community that for generations called this island home. But what strikes me about John Christian's account of those first inhabitants is how life on Norfolk Island has always ebbed and flowed, just like those waves that crash against its coastline. You see, it's a bit like sifting through the sedimentary layers of any archaeological dig. The story of Norfolk Island is a multi-layered one. So stay with me while I explore that story. And I should warn you, some of those layers ain't so pretty.
Is this what everyone does with their rubbish here on the island?
Yeah. It all goes down here.
But let's get to all that a bit later. Before we go on, let me take a moment to finish tracing the island's historical timeline. After the disappearance of the Polynesians, it would be hundreds of years before people set foot on Norfolk Island again. When they finally did, it was the Europeans who came, and as was their habit at the time, they established a penal settlement. The island's still strewn with the convict-hewn stone relics of that first settlement. But like the Polynesian village before it, that second settlement would end up being abandoned. Another settlement was re-established a few years later, this time primarily to serve as the dumping ground for mainland Australia's cast-offs, the worst description of convicts as they were called, sent to live and labour in a place 1,000 kilometres from anywhere. That third settlement was destined to be abandoned as well, only this time the departing colonial authorities presented the island to the Bounty descendants, who to their credit remain there to this day, such as their dogged determination to hold on to what they see as theirs.
We, the Norfolk Island people, dare to dream on the best future for Norfolk Island and its people.
Just a short distance from the place where a Polynesian community once thrived, a new settlement of sorts sprung up in the past year. The occupants of the small collection of tents and temporary shelters, some of those stubborn Norfolk Islanders fighting what they see as a new threat to their ongoing occupation of the island.
So we looked to our neighbours for a helping hand, and they said they'd come up with a plan.
Can I ask why you're here?
We're here to protest against the Australian government's actions in the reform process.
Pretty much, we're setting up a bit of a Norfolk Island embassy.
Joe Gillette is another descendant of the Bounty Mutineers, the Bountineers, as they like to call themselves, and many of them have been in open revolt against the mainland takeover, which saw their elected government dismissed. You see, many Norfolk Islanders were determined to go it alone when they were granted autonomy by an act of the Australian Parliament in the 1970s. So when it was taken away again, many of them decided to take matters into their own hands and pitch their tents on the grounds of their old government buildings.
Yeah, it's an organic thing at the moment. It's growing. Every day there's more tents and more protesters. It's just a quiet, peaceful protest.
But the changes have also divided Norfolk Islanders, with the community split between those like Joe Gillette, who feel they're being robbed of their birthright.
How long are you going to be here for?
As long as it takes. Pretty much. As long as it takes.
And others who argue the island has been in desperate need of a financial bailout from the Commonwealth. Some, like Denise Quintal, say the time was long overdue for an external authority to step in and clean up all the mess the islanders have made.
I don't call it a takeover. The Commonwealth could see that there were certain things over a period of years that were not being done, and it's got to a high risk time. This is high risk, and when you have high risk, someone has to step in and sort it out.
With a total area of less than 35 square kilometres, it doesn't take long to drive your way around Norfolk Island. The roads wind through lush fields and woodland and pass stunning coastline. But there's one part of the island that you won't see in the tourist brochures.
Unfortunately, it's been left to a state which has been unacceptable. Hi guys.
I'm riding with local woman Denise Quintal.
So we're now going to remove our waste as we would.
Okay, we get out of the car.
Denise is a bit of a local dynamo here on Norfolk Island. She's a marriage celebrant, but she's also set herself the task of ridding Norfolk Island of its
because
garbage.
We've got plastic and we've got glass and we've got steel.
Right now, Denise is giving me a tour of the island's waste transfer station to show me what's being done to stop the island choking on its own refuse.
If you look down there, it's sort of in a system we're trying to improve.
Now, Denise Quintal is pretty keen on the mainland takeover, in part because she reckons it's going to make it easier for islanders to get their rubbish removed. And no one can argue with the need to do something about that, because right now, Norfolk has a bit of a dirty little secret when it comes to its waste problem. You see, for years, they've just been tossing it in the otherwise pristine waters that surround the island.
We sea fill at the moment, which isn't acceptable.
What do you mean by sea fill?
What happens at the moment is most of this is burnt and then it is actually taken out to a site called Headstone, but unfortunately there's no other alternative at the moment.
Essentially, sea fill is just pushing the leftover waste into the ocean.
Yes, and as you can see, there's an awful lot of things that once burnt could be quite dangerous. So we have to stop that practice, and everyone wants to. It's not like we don't want to. It's just it was never addressed under the Legislative Assembly. Quite a bit of garbage, and of course we've worked it out, it's a kilo of waste per person per day. So each time you come to stay on the island, you've got to consider that you're leaving behind the waste, and on a small island, how do we deal with it?
Well, I'm a visitor to this island, I feel guilty now.
Well, I think we all do, and we all have to try and make this change together.
Mel!
But the problems don't end there. For years, hazardous materials like asbestos and chemicals have been getting packed into crates and stockpiled, awaiting the day they can be removed from the island.
Yes, what you see is an accumulation of a couple of years worth of asbestos.
Malcolm Snell is Norfolk Island's Waste Management Supervisor, and he's been working with Denise Quintal and the environmental organisations she's helped set up.
So it's been a struggle, but we're getting there, and it's definitely a godsend for us.
Boxes and boxes of car batteries here.
What have we got, Mel?
32 tonne of batteries there, ready for export. They just need to be washed, and well, they are washed. They're just sitting there waiting for the okay and the approvals and whatnot.
I hope she forgives me for saying so, but Denise Quintal seems to be quite a powerhouse when it comes to dealing with the waste issue. She seems to be encouraging everybody to clean up their act. Is that fair to say?
I won't, off the record, I won't tell you what sometimes I use, the words I use to describe Denise, but yeah, she's a jewel, yeah, for sure. We'll leave it at that.
Someone has to be the nagger in the kitchen, right? If you want the kitchen clean, you've got to keep working hard at making sure it stays clean. And the whole island wants that.
But even with the best will in the world, and Denise Quintal seems to have plenty of that, getting hazardous waste off the island presents its own challenges.
You know, it's at least 1,000 kilometres to the nearest land in any direction here.
Peter Adams is the operations manager of the Norfolk Island Administration.
In the case of asbestos, anything we export that's hazardous waste, we have to be able to demonstrate that it's going to be appropriately dealt with, safely dealt with, wherever it is that that's going.
And so that's my contribution to waste. But it's a slow process. Anything that you want good results, you must do it slowly.
Of course, a lot of things are done slowly on Norfolk. Island time, some call it. And sea dumping aside, there's plenty about the island's old ways that locals want kept exactly as they are.
And we continue with our program, and we have a track for you from Glen Campbell.
When I leave the waste transfer station, I'm keen to smell some fresh sea air again. And overlooking the ocean near Norfolk Island's main jetty, on what's known as Flagstaff Hill, I find the farm and home belonging to David Evans, or Dids Evans, as most people here call him.
You're known as Dids, so can I refer to you as Dids Evans?
Please do.
He and his forebears have lived on this hilltop with its sweeping views since they arrived on the island with the other Bountineers back in 1856.
Hey, Charles, I've been over to France and dig some sweet deity.
And like a lot of other descendants of the Bounty mutineers, Did speaks Norfolk Island's own indigenous language. Today, he and his daughter Chelsea have invited me into their home to learn more about the unique language they're trying to preserve.
Dad, I think we're going to do this night for supper. We're going to use the Yolof to do some green plum fritter.
Oh, yesterday afternoon I dig some sweet titty and I got one bunch of green plum and it's a full good. Yeah, we'll make bootha. We'll make some with green plum pancake and we'll put in a little bit of coconut milk.
Norfolk, as locals call it, is a kind of pidgin dialect. It's a mix of the old seafaring English used by the crew of the Bounty, blended with elements of the Polynesian language spoken by their Tahitian wives.
I thought last thing you dare worry about, yeah. Just precious hand, might kind of black from him sweet titty and him plum. But
you're right. Thanks for that, Joe. That's going to be heaps of fun.
Chelsea and Dids Evans, thanks very much for inviting me into your home, but I have to confess, I don't understand a single word you're saying. You're speaking the local Norfolk language, which, even though it has much of its origins in the English language, is pretty incomprehensible to me.
I don't think it's incomprehensible, and because it's our native tongue, it's very difficult for me to understand that you don't pick up on some of it.
What were you saying, Chelsea?
So what we were talking about is my dad, who's a farmer, he went and collected some fresh green bananas and also some sweet potatoes or kumara. And what we do, we use what's called a yolostone, which is a stone or a grater traditionally, which we have from Pitcairn Island.
And we will use this yolostone to grate both of those vegetables to make a sort of creamy mixture. You can fry the creamy banana, or you could put it into coconut milk and make another dish, which is called mudda.
Chelsea, I guess one of the things that a lot of mainland Australians don't really appreciate about Norfolk Island is you do have your own language. It's a very distinct culture and identity here on the island, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and I think what we find is that it is something that's so ingrained in us, like any other language you learn. It's part of you. So a lot of words, when you go away, they're still stuck with you. So Mawla means tomorrow for us, and even Yawli meaning all of you. So if you say, oh, hey, Yawli, you're saying, oh, hi, guys. It's those sort of terms that just stay with you forever, but it's part of our everyday life. It's what we use to speak to each other, and it's how we grow up. So it relates to us in every form of in our life and what we do here.
Certainly when Norfolk Islanders gather to celebrate big occasions, you do get a sense of why they're so proud of their unique identity. As a mainlander, I find Norfolk Island and its inhabitants both reassuringly familiar and a little strange at the same time. Not in the sense of weirdness, of course, I mean strange in the unfamiliar sense. Their language, their food and their music all bear the hallmarks of their distinctive blend of cultures, and their Polynesian roots shine through. It reminds me about those first Norfolk Islanders, the Polynesians who came here centuries ago and lived and thrived until something brought their own occupation to an abrupt end. And it still seems to me that their story holds an important clue to understanding this island. So, to find out more, I head to the island's museum, where curator Janelle Blucher shows me some of what they left behind.
In this cabinet, we have artefacts that were recovered from the official expeditions that occurred on the island between 1994 and 1997. And besides that as well, there's been quite a number of surface finds around the island.
So these are remnants of the Polynesian inhabitants of this island of hundreds of years ago here in this cabinet of the Norfolk Island Museum.
That's right, it's pretty special, isn't it? Let's begin in this cabinet here. They had their earth ovens. There were three scoop earth ovens found there. And in the cabinet here, we have the hearthstones that came from those earth ovens. And then further along, away from the homestead, of course, is the middens. So that's their refuse pits. And what that tells us is what they're actually eating.
An idea of their diet, because of course their diet was a large factor in explaining why they vanished from the island.
Quite possibly, yes, is the lack of food source on the island for the Polynesians. Could have been a climatic change like El Nino or something like that that sort of affected crops or fish stocks or something like that, we're not sure.
And as I reflect on my time on Norfolk Island, it strikes me there's a tiny paradox that lies at the heart of this special place. The island has so much rich and interesting history, but in lots of ways that's only been possible because life has been so transitory.
That's one of the things that makes Norfolk so special in historical terms is those layers of history, but each are significant, certainly in their own rights.
That's what they were feeding on. Run out of food and that was it. Had to go.
And back under the Norfolk pines with John Christian, it occurs to me that the island's long-lost Polynesian inhabitants might have left a message for those who followed.
Does the fact that a settlement like this appeared and disappeared on the island cause you to wonder about the long-term viability of your existence on this island, especially at a time when there's so much upheaval in the affairs of the island?
I don't think it'll make much difference to us. We'll still be here. That's for sure. I mean, they can change the government, but I don't think they'll change the people. Norfolk's always had booms and busts, and they were going through another bust. We'll pick up again and get going, don't worry.
Norfolk Islander John Christian ending that report from Nick Grimm.